This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Late night TV is now filled with hilarious political satire. What sets apart Full Frontal with Samantha Bee isn't just that it's hosted by a woman, it's that Bee is a feminist. And the head writer and showrunner, Joe Miller, is also a feminist. And that's the perspective they bring to their satire. And the Trump administration is giving them plenty of material to work with. Samantha Bee and Miller co-created Full Frontal. They first worked together on The Daily Show, where Bee was a correspondent and Miller was a writer. When Jon Stewart left The Daily Show, Bee was offered her own show, and she enlisted Miller to help her create it. Full Frontal airs Wednesdays on TBS and just started its second season. Let's start with a Full Frontal clip from the night after Election Day, when Samantha Bee was still shocked by Donald Trump's victory.
How did everyone get this so spectacularly wrong? Pollsters, the media, the Keeping It 1600 nerds, us. What was the X factor that none of the forecasts accounted for? Okay, I have a confession to make. A few years ago, I appeared on a little show called Law & Order.
You may know Vanessa Carvel. She's being blackmailed.
And soon after it aired, the 20-season hit series was canceled, even though there were still six people in New York who hadn't yet appeared on it. And then last year, I gave a tasteful interview in Playboy. The next day, Playboy canceled nudity. I guess I didn't notice the pattern because yesterday I voted in an American election for the first time and I broke America. I am so sorry. And please don't even think of writing something stupid like, what a lucky break a Trump presidency is for comedians. The jokes just write themselves. No, 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 shut up. Jokes don't write themselves. Jews write jokes, and they are scared shitless.
Samantha Bee, Joe Miller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having us.
So what was it like doing a show right after the election? I mean, had you planned on doing a show about President-elect Hillary Clinton?
Listen, we had a balloon drop planned. I will say that. We had balloons in our rafters, and it was, not... we had to call it. We donated our balloons to a different show.
We did prepare.
Did you really prepare?
Well, for things that were pre-taped, like for the cold open where everybody's running around celebrating that the election's over, we had taped an alternate ending for just in case, because we are stressed, anxious people who kind of Cassandra around expecting the worst. and the field department had shot some wonderful footage at the polls that day and planned a field piece and then needed to make a completely different field piece out of the same footage. And
at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. And Tyler just sat down in that edit and we check in on him from time to time. He's like, you okay? Yeah, I got it. It's great. Fine. And he turned out a beautiful field piece.
How did you come up with the idea that Samantha Bee broke America? Because every time she does something, it's canceled or it changes in some dramatic way.
I can tell you. I remember. I knew at 8:01 that
I know
what was going to happen, and everybody was still in denial. And around 10, I think around 10. Yeah, I pulled everyone into the writer's room, and they just sat there staring into space. And most of these people hadn't been through 2004 and didn't know that feeling. And Sam then told everybody the story about the other thing, the Law & Order and the Playboy.
Breaking our cherished cultural institutions.
Yeah, that was like throwing out this life preserver to everyone in the room, and we all grabbed onto it, and then we started talking about how to make it funny.
So before that,
it was silence.
Silence.
So how did Trump's election change the role you want your show to play?
By the time the election rolled around, we were all so excited and joyful. You know, we could see a different future for the show. We wanted to stop talking about the election.
God.
So many other things that we wanted to cover. It was kind of just this endless pool of stories we wanted to tell. And we thought
we had to get back to the States.
Get back to the States, you know, some predictability.
Cover Europe.
Yeah. And in that moment, you know, we were having a crisis in the office, a crisis of citizenship and a crisis, an American crisis, but also looking toward a future in which we knew we were going to have to dig in deep on this. And we knew that it was going to change the future of the show for however long it changed it. It just felt like we could see something dark on the horizon. And that was overwhelming for a long time. An interesting thing happened also as the election results were becoming more clear. I checked into my Twitter feed, and the tone of people's at mentions to me went into violence. Like, I can't even, it is indescribable what happened, but it just, I felt like the whole world shifted in those few hours in a way that was very, I mean, just everything about it was so unexpected, but I could feel this seismic shift in the way that people were interacting with me. It
so
was
what were you reading? Like misogynist tweets directed at you?
Oh my God, it was unbelievable. I literally had to turn my notifications off.
Took your phone away.
Everyone took my phone away because it put me into such a dark place for a couple of really bad days.
So wait, so President Trump won and you became more of a target? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I could feel me personally being a target, but the show,
it was vicious.
It was vicious.
And a little kind of scary.
Right out of the gate. And in that moment, I kind of understood the way it was going to be from then on. And at that point, everyone took away my Twitter because it was making me too depressed.
And it was like night and day when we took it away. It's like, oh, Sam's back.
Yeah. I really needed to lose touch with that element, and which has been very effective. My notifications have been off ever since.
It's good to be reminded that that's not the real world.
It's not the real world.
Okay, let's hear another bit from Full Frontal. And this is your take on Kellyanne Conway. That was recorded on January 18th. So this is just like a couple of days before the inauguration. And she, of course, was Donald Trump's campaign manager, now counselor to the president, who's being seen increasingly less and less over time. So here's Samantha Bee a couple of days before the inauguration.
The top five or six feminists chosen late night. We're all about celebrating the achievements of fierce, brave, strong women. Well, that and dildo jokes, but mainly women. And tonight we want to celebrate a truly special female woman. Donald Trump's omnipresent spokes cobra, Kellyanne Conway, or as Fox News calls her,
the first woman to run a winning presidential campaign in the history of this country.
First woman to be ever lead and win a presidential campaign.
The first woman to run a successful presidential campaign.
Jesus, Fox, stop ramming your feminist identity politics down America's throats. But they're right. Kellyanne did turn Trump's upended porta potty of a campaign around and get him elected pretty much single-handedly while raising four children and probably being interrupted every 3 minutes by the alpha bro jockstraps Trump likes to surround himself with. She is amazing at her job and she deserves credit. But for some reason, not everyone is celebrating Kellyanne's victory for womanhood.
I gotta think that if Kellyanne Conway was on the left, I'd be seeing her on the cover of Vogue. But the left, not big fans.
Oh my God, you guys, it's so unfair. A woman pulls off the historic feat of electing a sexual predator who thinks women should be punished for having abortions, and feminists don't celebrate her with a Vogue cover. Although, she did get the cover of Grabber Enabler Monthly, so I guess that's something.
So I think it's very interesting that you came up with a feminist take on Kellyanne Conway. So can you talk a little bit about the process of figuring out what your angle was going to be to talk about Kellyanne Conway?
Well, she is an accomplished professional.
She pretty much did pull that off single-handed. I mean, she
really did.
Very good at her job.
Mm-hmm.
She will do or say anything. And she was surrounded by a bunch of male boobs who couldn't find their own ass with a map.
Mm-hmm. Yep. She does. I really absolutely think that she does deserve credit for that.
Yeah.
I wish that she hadn't done it.
Right. I mean, I feel the same way I did about Thatcher. Like, I lived in Britain then. It was not a pleasant time. But props to her and what she had to put up with on a daily basis. She's another one who had to change her voice because it was too shrill.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And also, we disagree with Kellyanne on everything and hate watching what she does on the news shows. But I know that she's gotten the same kind of personal, nasty, misogynist attacks that Sam has.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets called names and called ugly and really inappropriate, horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
The way that any public woman does, and that's wrong. We had a whole We had this whole debate in the rewrite because we wanted to make sure that we didn't say anything that could be construed by anybody as being looksist or sexist or, you know, a personal attack on her and instead of the way she lives her life and does her business.
Yeah, you did in another edition call, you did call her a flaxen-haired fountain of lies.
Well, that's accurate.
Yep.
I just stand behind those words.
Okay.
Flaxen-haired is pretty. That's a compliment.
Yeah, that's nice.
Okay.
And she's a fountain of lies.
And she is a fountain of lies.
I mean, I don't.
A beautiful cascading Bellagio of mendacity.
So you've been working together since you were on The Daily Show.
God, it feels like a thousand years.
It feels like another person's life.
Really?
In a lot of ways. Yeah.
So when you decided to work together to create a new show, how did you figure out what the format was going to be? How did you figure out what you wanted?
We knew from the very beginning what we wanted. And we knew that we wanted the show to come from a very visceral place. We knew that we wanted it to be a really authentic expression
of
what we were feeling
out of our hearts.
We didn't know how the, you know, the acts would break down, and we didn't know what the set would look like or what. And
we knew no desk.
We knew that there would be no desk. That's also something that
we
didn't know blazers yet.
Why no desk?
We just couldn't. I'm just personally, as a viewer and as a consumer of late night shows, I just can't. I didn't want to see another one. I just didn't want to see another desk. We knew that our show would be different in many ways. I don't think we knew exactly how it would be different. We just knew that it would be. And part of that was just breaking that format, just this really simple gesture of breaking the format of sitting behind a desk. When I sit behind things, I can't move my body. It's very constricting. It becomes like, for me, it would have been a crutch. And believe me, I was very scared to not have a desk because I thought, wouldn't it be great to have something to hide behind? I need something that I can scoot behind so that I just need it. But in the end, I didn't need it at all. And I'm so glad that we really don't have anything for me to hide behind. It's better that way.
The men on the late night shows wear suits. So, you know, the suits might vary, but, you know, in some ways, a suit is a suit. Whereas you've developed a look that you have on the show. How did you develop that look?
Well, it's very similar to the uniform that I wear in daily life. I wear blazers in my life. I love them. I feel very protected in a blazer. It's my uniform. And when we were in the early days of doing test shows, I had it in my head that I had to wear a dress and high heels. I really did. I thought, okay, when you're a woman and you're on television, you have to wear a dress and you have to wear high heels. And then we did another test show, and I was wearing high heels, and the heels were so they were such stilettos that the heels were poking through the they were poking through the floor of the set, and it was terrible. And we were like, what is she going to do about the high heels? Can you wear a block heel? And I was like, no, they have to be stilettos. And then and actually a couple of executives from DBS were there, and they pulled me aside after, and they were like, you were so comfortable. You seemed to be having so much fun in rehearsal when you were wearing sneakers and a blazer, and then you put on your outfit for the show, and you seem like you're having a terrible time. And they were right. I was having a terrible time because I was so physically uncomfortable. And they were like, why don't you just do the show in the clothes that you want to wear? And I was like, you can do that? I think I will. Thank you. So it was actually a really great,
That was a good network note.
Yeah, it really was.
So you are both from really different backgrounds. Sam, I remember one of the times I interviewed you, you told me that when you were a teenager, you stole cars with friends.
Yes, I did.
Whereas
my boyfriend.
Joe, with your boyfriend, okay.
Whereas my bad boyfriend.
You went to Yale. You were a Fulbright scholar. Then went to Cornell, where you received your PhD.
I left before I got
my
PhD.
Oh, I thought you got it. Okay, I've been misinformed.
But your
area of specialization, as far as I know, was medieval Jewish history.
Yep. Laugh riot.
What were you thinking your future was going to be when you were studying medieval Jewish history?
I was going to be a history teacher, like some of the people I admired the most. I was going to hole up in the academy and let the temporal world slide by outside, barely noticing it. I did comedy on my own time. I mean, I was in an improv group at college. Steve Bodo, who's the showrunner over at The Daily Show, and I were the founding directors of that group. Steve was the one who called me and asked me to apply at the Daily Show. And there was comedy. I mean, if you're studying pogroms, you kind of have to do something to make yourself laugh.
Well, while we're on the subject, when you were studying anti-Semitism in medieval times, are there some mm-hmm. kind of tropes from then that, mm-hmm. that you're seeing now? Like, were yes. gravestones overturned in medieval times?
That is not recorded. There are common themes. One is the popular notion among people who study medieval Jewish history that there's a sort of natural antipathy among the uneducated masses that just bubbles up from time to time because, you know, the masses, the peasants hate Jews, and that is not how it works. It's always engineered from above. It's engineered through propaganda campaigns by people with vested interests in using prejudice and outbursts of popular hostility. It comes from above. The myths like blood libels, they emerge as later justifications for the violence that has happened, which is also what you see in the South with lynchings. The violence comes first, then you have to justify the violence because if you need to have had a reason, otherwise you're a bad person. So, you know, black men rape white women. That's, you know, the violence comes first and it comes from the top. Back
yeah.
to comedy.
Anyway, full frontal.
Is there any language?
Never ask me about this.
No. I'm going on. Is there any language or any stereotypes, any myths that you're hearing today that date back as far as medieval times or further that you're aware of?
Yeah, I remember when I was in grad school and the ritual murder accusations cropped up again in Bosnia and were used against Muslims. Mm-hmm. They're always lying around. There are these weapons lying around for you to just pick up and
What are use. Those the ritual murder accusations?
That Jews, or in the case of Bosnia, Muslims, would kidnap Christian children and either crucify them in a reenactment of Jesus' crucifixion or bleed them to death to drink their blood or mix their blood into the food. That which I should add isn't true.
You said these waves of anti-Semitism always come from above and then trickle down. So is
that
what
I've experienced. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that what you feel like you've been witnessing?
Now we have the internet. Old libels and old anti-Semitic myths, particularly Nazi ones, are pressed into service again. This is how you see the Lügenpresse, the lying press, bubble up again. That's how people are radicalized online. Aside from specifically anti-Semitism, I think hostility to a vulnerable subpopulation is used by people in power for their own ends.
Let's get back to, Joe, your work studying medieval Jewish history and planning to become a history teacher or a history professor. Was there a part of you thinking, but what I really want to do is comedy, but I can't do that?
Yes.
I can't become a comedian or a comic writer, so I'd better just keep to history.
Yes. Yes.
Why did you think that?
Because I'm a girl and I hate myself like girls do. Oh, that's exactly why. I was in, when Liz Winstead started The Daily Show in 1996, and I was watching it from day one, and I had these little fantasies of going to work for Liz Winstead, but that's all it was a fantasy. I later did work for Liz Winstead on Wake Up World, and she taught me so much. She's a wonderful person. When I was at The Daily Show, we would have interns, college kids, every semester, and at the end they would gather in the writer's lounge and to ask us questions, and we'd ask them questions about what they wanted to do. They'd be half men, half women. And we'd ask them, do you want to be a writer? And go down the line, and the men would all say, yeah, I'm going to be a writer. I'm Jake. I'm going to be mm-hmm. a writer. I'm Carl. I'm going to write. And the women would say, I'm Amanda. Yeah, maybe someday. I'm not good enough.
We'll see. I don't know. I might go into teaching.
Yeah, and finally one day I just had a meltdown. Mm-hmm. You know, somewhere between the unearned confidence of the men and the unjustified self-censorship of the women is the truth lies. Yes, mm-hmm. none of you are good enough. You just started. Mm-hmm. You do it and you'll get good. And we plucked some our best writers out of other fields, like, you know, journalism. Our best writers mm-hmm. at The Daily Show, like Tim Carvel, who's running John Oliver's show, came from journalism. And that's, we're not, the women are out there doing journalism, doing academics, doing social work, doing lawyer stuff. Mm-hmm. And we just have to find them because they're sitting there like I was sitting in Ithaca going, I suck. Boy, it'd be fun to write for The Daily Show if I didn't suck. They're out there.
It seems like a very far away dream.
Yes.
It seems like a very far away dream.
So, Sam, did you experience the kind of thing that Joe was talking about of thinking like, I'm not good enough to actually be a comedian?
Oh, my God. Of course. Oh, of course. I lived my whole—I've been a fan of comedy and just like a very deep fan of comedy my entire life. But I never grew—I mean, I grew up in Canada also, and, you know, comedy coming out of the United States, it feels completely inaccessible. I came to comedy very late in life for a comedy person, late 20s. It never occurred to me to do comedy in my entire life until someone literally forced me to do it, until friends who I'd worked on a play with needed to replace a woman in their sketch troupe, and they forced me to say yes to them and assured me that I would love it. And they were correct to do so, and I did love it. And it really changed the direction of my life. And I found that I was quite good at it, but someone had to force me into it.
Maybe we need conscription if we introduced a draft.
Yeah. Yes.
Just
yeah.
Force women into, because you and I were mm-hmm. career waitresses.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, God. Definitely.
What kind of restaurants?
Terrible ones. Oh, God. I worked in an all-night pancake house for a really long time in a terrible cockroach-infested seafood restaurant. I worked at a place where I had to wear a name tag. Oh, I don't think it exists anymore. It was called Joe Badali's in Toronto. And I had to wear a name tag that said Samantha Badali. I still have it.
Wait, like you were all sister wives?
We were all sister wives. Yeah, we were all
creepy.
Joe's wives. Mm-hmm. Joe's concubines.
Do you still have the waiter nightmares?
I still have waiter nightmares. I will never not have waiter nightmares.
Yeah, still have them.
I honestly think that part of my very visceral reaction to Donald Trump is because I served so many people in the restaurant who were just like him. I have PTSD from it.
What do you mean when you say
I worked
that?
In
what
Washington.
Are you picking up on?
A man in a suit, mm-hmm. an arrogant business person. The man who is at the head of the table who says, if you give us good service tonight, I'll give you a pretty sweet tip. Mm-hmm. Give us extra special service. I mean,
hey,
that
toots.
Is, yeah. Right. It's in my DNA.
What are you like on the menu?
Oh, do you serve Groper? And they don't tip. And
they don't.
They never tip.
They don't because nobody can see them signing the bill.
Nope.
So they'll make a big, you know,
it's a
show
very,
of taking the bill.
There's a showmanship to it.
And put your 6% down.
The tip is very lean.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. This was great.
Thank you.
Samantha Bee and Joe Miller are the creators of the political satire series Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. Bee is the host. Miller's the head writer and showrunner. Full Frontal airs Wednesday nights on TBS. Now film critic Justin Chang has a review of the new film Personal Shopper, a paranormal thriller set in and around the Paris fashion world. It stars Kristen Stewart, who won a César Award in 2015 for her performance in Clouds of Sils Maria, which was written and directed by the French filmmaker Olivier Assayas. They've reteamed for the new movie.
Personal Shopper, Olivier Assayas's moody, baffling, and altogether entrancing new movie, takes the form of a genre exercise as preposterous as it is irresistible. It begins as a chilling ghost story, accelerates into a Hitchcockian railway thriller, takes a sharp turn into whodunit territory, and ends somewhere alongside the abyss that separates this world from the next. Above all, the movie is a testament to the eerie powers of Kristen Stewart. In Clouds of Sils Maria, her previous collaboration with Assayas, Stewart playfully tweaked her celebrity persona by taking on the role of an actress's assistant. Here, she plays Maureen Cartwright, an American living in Paris, who works as a personal shopper for a jet-setting celebrity named Kyra. By day, Maureen rides around the city on her motorcycle, stopping by various fashion houses and picking up leather pants and glittering accessories with which to fill Kyra's enormous closet. But being a stylist to the stars isn't Maureen's true calling. She's a medium, and she's determined to communicate with the spirit of her late twin brother, Louis, who died of a congenital heart defect that she, too, suffers from. At night, Maureen visits her brother's abandoned old house, wondering if he will make contact. Asayas has delirious fun playing with the conventions of the haunted house genre, faucets that turn on by themselves, noisily rattling chandeliers, and even a brief, spooky appearance by a digital poltergeist. But Personal Shopper is after more than a few gotcha moments. Beneath all this paranormal activity is a profound and layered examination of grief. Whether or not Lewis's death has opened up a portal to the great beyond is never fully spelled out. But it's clear enough that Maureen has been deeply altered by her loss, to the point that she no longer feels like the same person. In one scene, she finds herself talking to Kyra's boyfriend, played by Lars Eidinger, and Stuart, as usual, proves herself a master of revealing much, while seeming to say very little.
What are you doing in Paris?
I'm waiting. I'm gonna go.
What are you waiting for?
My brother died here. My twin brother died in Paris.
An accident?
No, heart attack. I actually have the same malformation.
Does it scare you?
No. I didn't scare him.
You are staying here to mourn.
No, I'm waiting. I told you I was waiting.
What are you waiting for?
So we made this oath. Whoever died first would send the other a sign.
A sign? From the afterlife?
You could call it that. You could call it a million things.
But how do you know if it's a sign?
I'm a medium. He was a medium. I'll just know it.
But Maureen doesn't know what to make of the mysterious presence that suddenly starts sending her teasing, menacing text messages out of the blue. Their conversation, completely silent except for the occasional buzz of Maureen's phone, becomes the film's centerpiece, a 20-minute tour de force of suspense filmmaking. Is this her brother finally making contact? Or is it someone else trying to fool her for some nefarious reason? Asayas never comes right out and answers. His larger point seems to be that technology has, to some extent, made ghosts of us all. Phones and computers have turned us into fleeting, spectral presences, ostensibly more connected, yet in fact more isolated from each other than ever. Maureen rarely sees her boss, who communicates entirely via handwritten notes. In her free time, Maureen Skypes half-heartedly with her long-distance boyfriend, and watches video lectures on the Swedish abstract artist Hilma af Klint, whose paintings reflected her own forays into the spirit realm. Personal Shopper is a powerful portrait of solitude, and an incredible one-woman show for Stuart, who could be the most fascinatingly self-effacing movie star working today. She's the rare actress who can blur effortlessly into the background and magnetize the camera in the same instance. It's fitting that her character here is a medium, a go-between. Whether she's buying couture for someone else to wear, or trying to communicate with the dead, she gives the impression of someone not entirely at home with herself or her place in the mortal realm. Personal Shopper shows us a young woman racked with indecision, but there's never any doubt that Kristen Stewart knows exactly what she's doing.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. My guest Mohsen Hamid has written a novel about immigration that was described in the New York Times as creating a fictional world that captures perils of the world we live in now, with wars like the one in Syria turning cities into war zones, with political crises, warp speed technological changes, and growing tensions between nativists and migrants. The novel is about a young couple in a city slowly being overtaken by militants and extremists. Beheadings are becoming common. The city is unnamed, but it resembles Lahore, Pakistan, where Hamid lives. The novel examines the difficulty of knowing when it's time to flee, how it feels to leave family behind, and what it's like to arrive in another country that's hostile to immigrants. Mohsen Hamid was born in Lahore, Pakistan, but spent part of his childhood in California, where his father was studying at Stanford. Hamid returned to the U.S. to study at Princeton and Harvard Law School. He lived in New York in his 20s and London in his 30s, but moved back to Lahore with his wife to raise their children. His other novels include The Reluctant Fundamentalist and How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. His new novel is called Exit West. Mohsen Hamid, welcome back to Fresh Air. You had no way of knowing that the publication of your novel about migration would coincide with President Trump's second version of an executive order blocking migrants from several Muslim-majority countries. Do you think your novel addresses that ban without mentioning it by name?
In a sense, yes, because the ban is about trying to determine, you know, who belongs and who doesn't belong in a place, above all. Of course, it also has the effect of restricting certain people's movements, and in some cases, like refugees, with potentially deadly effect. But above all, it's about who has the right to move and who doesn't have the right to move. And I think that when we take the long view, the notion that some people are deemed, you know, less worthy of being able to move, to not have the right to cross borders, over time, that's going to seem to us as outmoded and as unfair, really, as racial discrimination or other kinds of discrimination. So yes, the book does address the ban without specifically addressing the ban.
I'm really interested in hearing what the discussion is like in Pakistan now about Trump's anti-immigrant policies. The discussion both among your friends and family, but also in the press.
Well, my 7-year-old daughter was frightened that I was going to America. And she had come to New York with me and my wife and our other child, our son, in August. We stayed for a month and she loved it. And if you asked her in perhaps September, her favorite place in the world, she might have said New York. But when I was coming to America just now from Pakistan, she was saying, you know, Baba, don't go. And among the 7-year-olds in her class, there's a fear that there's this person out there. She knows his name is Trump. And she thinks that he hates Muslims, that he is not nice to women, that in a sense that he's a villain. And I think that sentiment at the level of a child, because she could probably name no other international political figure, that's becoming quite widespread, the notion that there's a person who's the head of the most powerful country in the world who dislikes so many people around the world. And naturally, that creates a sense of resentment and dismay.
There's a fear among a lot of Americans that Trump's policies will radicalize people and radicalize Muslims who might otherwise be very pro-America and supportive of American values. Do you see any evidence of that?
Well, I think there are perhaps two parts to it. Outside of America, there are many people, myself included, who champion values that in some senses could be thought of as traditionally American. The idea that everybody's equal, that the rights of women and men should be the same, that there should be no discrimination on religious or sexual orientation, that democracy and rule of law and due process are the ways in which society should govern themselves and minorities should be cared for. These, in a way, are values that America has championed internationally. Not exclusively, of course, America has a mixed history. But I think for many people around the world, the sense is that they've lost an ally, that this very powerful force that used to speak for these things is now silent. And that's the difference from radicalization. At the same time, I think radicalization works in a slightly different way. When people, particularly young people, and especially young men, can't imagine themselves as heroes in narratives that they construct for themselves, they look to be heroes in some other way. So young men in America of, let's say, Muslim background, only a tiny, tiny minority, so small as to be almost zero, are likely to ever commit terrorist acts. But what goes through the mind of somebody like that? You know, very often, if you look at the kinds of communications that they're getting in an ISIS recruiting video, the videos that you know that one hears as radicalizing them, these are like action movies. And so, in the sense, it's that by closing off the idea that young Muslims and particularly young Muslim men can be American heroes, it increases the chance that they'll try to be some other kind of hero. And that, I think, is entirely counterproductive.
Let's talk about your novel, Exit West, which is about a young man and a young woman who kind of fall in love in Pakistan and eventually decide, well, I shouldn't say Pakistan, it's an unnamed country that I assume is modeled on Pakistan, because that's where you live. But anyways, they kind of fall in love, or they think they've fallen in love, and slowly things in their country start to get to the point where it's becoming increasingly dangerous to live there. And the question is always in the background, how do you know when it's time to leave? And in the novel, things start changing slowly. It's tolerable at first. And then a turning point is the first time that a person you know is killed. And you're right, in time of violence, there is always that first acquaintance or intimate of ours who, when they are touched, makes what had seemed like a bad dream suddenly eviscerating real. And for these two people, one of the things that makes the danger real is that they know a middle-aged local man who ran a small side business who was beheaded with a serrated knife to enhance his pain. Then his body was strung up by one ankle from an electricity pole. So was there a first person for you who you knew who was touched by the violence of the Taliban in Pakistan?
Well, not necessarily by the Taliban, but certainly by extremists. The first person that I knew personally that I can think of in this moment, I had lunch with the governor of our province, and he was the husband of my mother-in-law's best friend. And he had been campaigning to remove or change the country's blasphemy law, which he argued was being used to victimize religious minorities, particularly Christians. And this was an unpopular position among, you know, certain strands of the religious right in Pakistan. And his own bodyguard assassinated him. And, you know, I remember meeting his family and coming for the funeral. And this is a person who was alive and speaking, you know, the day before. And then the day later, a day later, was gone. It was an incredible shock. It's always a shock when somebody dies. But in this case, really, it marked a change. It felt real. And also, it might be worth pointing out that, you know, so often people say, well, you know, why don't Muslims, you know, speak out, and why don't they? And I think people who say that have no idea what's going on in countries like Pakistan, where there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, millions speaking out. And in the case of my family friend, people who, you know, risk their lives to stand up for the rights of Christian minorities in Pakistan. And in fact, I've been to the funeral of somebody who did that. So it was enormously jarring and shocking. And also a reminder that many good people around the world are willing to risk everything to live inside a decent society.
In your novel, when your main characters migrate, they basically slip through portals, through doors, and are immediately in another country. So it's a kind of like magical touch to your novel, but it's also, it seems like a very convenient device for a novelist, because you don't have to get them like visas and put them on like a boat or a plane and have them pass through customs. You know, like you don't have to deal with any of that in the narrative, and you can keep it really lean. And like,
absolutely,
they're suddenly in another country. Was that one of your reasons for doing it that way?
Yeah. I mean, partly I feel the doors kind of already exist. They are a representation of a technological reality we already live inside. We can open up our computers and Skype with someone and we see them. It's like looking through a window, or we can surf the internet through our phones and it's like our consciousness is far away, or we can step through a airplane door and be in another continent a few hours away. So technology feels to me like the doors sort of already exist, at least emotionally. But in the novel, it was important to me to focus on what makes someone want to leave, which is all of their life before migration, and what happens to them in the new place, which is the life after migration, which is something that every human being participates in. The part of the story that often gets emphasized, how did you cross the Atlantic, or how did you cross the Pacific, or how did you cross the Mediterranean in a little boat which capsized and people died, that is a very dramatic and horrific, in some cases, part of the story. But it's a tiny moment, usually, in the time and in the emotional journey. I wanted to focus on the more human and lasting stories of Sayyidina Nadia, what happens before you move and what happens after. And so the doors allowed me to focus on parts of the migration narrative that often get de-emphasized. The other thing, of course, is the doors allow the world to change very quickly. So the next century of two migration that are likely to happen on planet Earth in the novel occurs in just a year or two.
A question that's raised in the novel about your main characters, which I'd be interested in hearing your reflections about, is in a new country, do you share this bond with migrants from other countries or only with migrants from your country?
Yes.
And it's an example of like when I'm in another city far away and I find myself sitting next to somebody from my neighborhood in Philadelphia, it's like, wow, we have so much in common. We're from the same neighborhood. Or from the same city, whereas if I run into them in the neighborhood, they're just a stranger to me. It doesn't mean a thing.
You know, sometimes we are looking for somebody we can connect with on the basis of a shared past or tradition or experience. And so finding that you're sitting next to someone very much like you in terms of where they come from is enormously reassuring. I think sometimes feeling that you've been marginalized opens you up to the realization that in their own lives, almost everyone experiences marginalization, a kind of foreigner sense. And that has, in my fiction in particular, and particularly my later fiction, made me investigate and explore the idea that we're all united in this, that every human being migrates through time, that the place we grew up in our childhood is gone when we're in our 50s and 60s and 70s. You can live in the same city your entire life and still be completely a foreigner when you step out in your old age onto the street. And that is the basis, I think, for asserting a kind of shared human experience. So whereas if you'd asked me this 25 years ago, would I say international people are my clan? I probably would have said yes. But now I quite enjoy meeting people who haven't moved, don't feel at all international, and recognizing an enormous shared experience that they also have with me.
On the dust jacket of your new book, there's a photo, an author photo, and you have a pretty short beard. And if you don't mind my asking, is the beard because you're better off with one if you live in Pakistan or because you like the style of it?
No, I don't think it makes any difference if you have a beard in a city like Lahore. I mean, for some people, it's a signifier of different kinds of religious things. For me, it's never been that. I'm pretty close to bald, and so I think the beard helps offset. It's the only hairstyle I can really pull off. But I'm often clean shaven. I think, you know, for me, it's not that signifier. What's interesting to me, though, is although the beard isn't a signifier of that to me, other people very often think that it is. And so people in America might react differently. The border agents might react differently. The guys at airport security might react differently. And people in Pakistan sometimes react differently. So a beard is something that is almost like a mirror to the viewer. When someone sees you wearing a beard, they're seeing something in their own imagination. Because it's still me, whether I'm bearded or not.
So the beard could be a positive in Pakistan and a negative in the U.S., particularly at an airport.
Yeah, or the other way around. So, for example, in some contexts in Pakistan, maybe a beard is negative. It depends. And in some contexts in America, maybe a beard is positive. I think there's certainly lots of hipster communities where having a beard makes me look a little bit less like a middle-aged fuddy-duddy. And there's some places in Pakistan where having a beard certain corporate contexts, certain social contexts, where it's not an advantage to have a beard.
Something that you have to navigate so that people don't assume you're a terrorist and so that people don't assume you're a middle-aged fuddy-duddy.
It's amazing the range of places that I can, occupy from deeply dangerous to so undangerous as to be completely desexualized. It's a wonderful canvas on which I can live out my different facial hair experiments.
It is lucky you have a sense of humor about that.
There's no other way around it. I think life is too short to go around you being continually, angry about being seen in this way. But that said, the anger is useful too, because when things about the world upset you, that is really a fertile feeling to channel into fiction and to put out into books.
So one more question. How do you deal with anxiety?
I think that we live in a world, and this is something which living in Pakistan perhaps has taught me, and you know, we live in a world where there is a constant feed from social media, the news, etc., of things that can scare us.
Mm-hmm.
And we become so anxious because human beings are designed to be sensitized to dangerous stuff. You know, you get a bad review as a writer, you remember it for 10 years. You get 100 good reviews, you forget them all. You say hello to 100 people in a city and it doesn't mean anything to you. One racist comment passes by and sticks with you a decade. We keep the negative stuff because it's the negative stuff that's going to, you know, potentially kill us. That fin in the water, maybe it is a shark. That yellow thing behind the tree, maybe it is a lion. You need to be scared. But contemporary culture in Pakistan, just like in America, is continuously hitting us with scary stuff. And so we are utterly anxious. I think that it's very important to resist that anxiety, to think of ways of resisting the constant inflow of negative feelings. Not to become depoliticized as a result, but to actually work actively to bring into being an optimistic future. And for me, writing books and being, you know, someone who's politically active is part of that. Is I don't want to be anxious on my day-to-day life. I want to try to imagine a future I'd like to live in and then write books and do things that in my own small way make it more likely that that future will come to exist.
I wish you success with that. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Mohsen Hamid's new novel is called Exit West. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, Mood Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.